Gosh, Dr. Von Stereotype, thanks for seeing me on such short notice.
Oh, don't worry, come in, have a seat here on the couch. Now, you said on the phone that you are suffering from feelings of inadequacy. Why is that, do you think?
Well, Doc, see, I'm an online horror movie reviewer.
Oh, I understand everything now. So that's why you are feeling inadequate. You
well,
live
no,
at home
hey,
with
wait
your
a
mommy.
Minute.
Hmm?
No,
and
no,
do
I...
do you have a girlfriend?
Well, no, because...
I didn't think so.
No, I have a wife.
Oh, you do?
Yes, I do, and stop looking at me like that. See, I'm a member of a group called the Beemasters Cabal. And we were doing a round table called Shame of the Beemasters.
That is quite a big reverb you've got there. Are you trying perhaps to compensate for something?
No, the reverb comes standard with our disembodied brain jars. Anyway, the theme of this installment was movies we should have seen, but for whatever reason we hadn't. The more embarrassing the movie, the better. So, you know, I did that part. I chose my movie.
And what bad movie was that?
Well, that's just the thing. It wasn't a bad movie. It was a good movie. In fact, it was a classic. So I went ahead and I watched the movie, and I did a podcast for it. I went to upload it just before the round table deadline, even though I had to fight a whole bunch of technical hurdles to do it. See, I'd never done a podcast before.
Well, then why did you do one this time?
Because of the confessional nature of the round table, I thought it would be best to try and communicate with the audience as directly as possible in my own voice.
No, really, why did you do it?
Oh, all right. I didn't want to reveal the name of the movie until I absolutely had to. I thought people would, you know, point and laugh. So anyway, I was all ready to make the podcast live when I discovered something.
And that was?
The podcast sucked. I found out I just didn't have anything to say about the movie.
And has that ever stopped anyone from posting on the internet before?
I hadn't thought of that, but I just didn't feel right about it, and... now I've missed the round table, and I just don't know where to turn. I feel so ashamed.
Dear, now it's nothing a little expensive therapy won't fix.
Doctor, it's just that... hey, how expensive?
Never mind about that. Why don't you tell me a little about this movie you didn't see? What was the movie?
Oh. Well, okay. To tell the story properly, I have to go back to my childhood in the 1970s.
Oh, boy,
things
here
were
we
very
go.
Different back then.
Yeah.
Do you remember what TV was like back then, Doc?
Yes, I do. There is no need.
It was before
need.
Video, or at least before affordable video. The Betamax came out in the 1970s, but nobody I knew could afford one, and certainly we couldn't. There was no cable like we have today, either, and we had an old black-and-white TV set because we couldn't afford color until prices came down in the 80s.
Ah, so you felt deprived.
Oh, no, not at all. See, a lot of the movies we watched back then were in black-and-white anyway. We didn't mind. Anyway, there were two dials on the television. The upper dial clicked into place for channels from 2 through 13, and those were the VHF, or very high-frequency channels. Now, just because they were on the dial didn't mean there were local channels broadcasting on those frequencies, so some of those channels, depending on where you lived, only gave you static. Now, in place of the 1 on the dial was a letter U, and that stood for UHF, or ultra-high frequency, and there you had about 70 more channels that were theoretically available to you, again, if you had stations in your area that broadcast on those frequencies. When I was growing up, I lived in between the New York and Philadelphia metropolitan areas, and as I recall, we had about 5 additional channels that we got on UHF, so that was what the broadcast landscape looked like back then. The thing about UHF was this. The dial to tune in the channels didn't have preset positions on it the way the VHF dial did. If we wanted to go from, say, channel 29 to channel 48, we had to adjust the dial like the dial on a car radio until we got to the right position. And that position would change from day to day, or even from moment to moment, depending on where we lived and what kind of weather we were having that day. So some days we just couldn't get our favorite channels at all. So channel surfing was a much more labor-intensive and painful experience.
Aha!
Oh, what is it, Doc? Do you think the trauma of channel surfing may have affected my development?
What? No, sorry, I was bored. I was doodling. Look, I made a ducky!
Oh, it's a very nice ducky. Now, where was I?
You don't need to...
Oh, yeah. So if we wanted to watch a movie, we had two choices. We could wait for it to come on TV, and first of all, hope we found out about it. Which is why we kids studied the TV guide from cover to cover every time it came out. But then hoped that we got the channel that day. Or the alternative was we could wait for it to come back to the movie theaters, which was even more of a long shot.
So that was the movie you didn't see.
I'm getting to that. See, it was okay in those days because regular, ordinary TV channels would show all kinds of movies all the time. Saturdays in those days were crammed full of horror and sci-fi movies all day long, while in the evenings, there'd always be a Sherlock Holmes movie with Basil Rathbone, and that would be followed by a Charlie Chan, or sometimes they'd substitute a Thin Man movie with William Powell, just to keep things from getting stale. And then Sundays would be family movies, like Abbott and Costello flicks, or Three Stooges, or movies with Errol Flynn and John Wayne and Spencer Tracy. And during the week, there was the 4:30 movie on WABC. It was Channel 7 in New York, and they'd have weeks of themed programming. Sometimes they'd take some ridiculously long epic, like Quo Vadis or Ben-Hur, and they'd split it up over the whole week, so you'd have to watch for an hour and a half every day to see the whole thing. But then they'd also have Vincent Price Week, and Planet of the Apes Week, and best of all was Monster Week. 5 days of Japanese monster movies. They'd have Monster from a Prehistoric Planet, and Doggera the Space Monster, and Frankenstein Conquers the World, and always at least one Gamera flick. And all the time you'd get this fantastic variety of films from the 30s all the way through drive-in stuff that had just been in the theaters a few weeks ago, like Octoman, or The Witchmaker, or Count Yorga the Vampire, and of course, Beware the Blob, which became my very favorite movie of all time from the first time I saw it on the 4:30 movie until, you know, it's still my very favorite movie of all time. Anyway, this is what I think. When you have a choice, when you have the whole history of cinema on pristine, uncut DVD to pick and choose from, you tend to fall into patterns with what you decide to watch and what you decide to inflict on your family. You know what you want to see, and you have control over when and how you want to see it, so you tend to gravitate toward the things you know you're going to like. But when you didn't have any control, well, first of all, you rearranged your schedule as much as you could to be around when your favorite show was on, and that was no mean feat for an elementary school kid. That you really appreciated it when it did come on, and it really, really hurt when you couldn't watch for whatever reason. But also, if you had the time and wanted to watch something, and what you wanted to watch wasn't on, you could always try something else, and chances are there was something really good on at some point that you wouldn't necessarily have chosen to watch, but you did watch it. Anyway, you didn't have to go to some specialty cable channel that only shows that kind of thing. The movies were everywhere, and you got a little bit of everything, and that's how I, as a little kid, managed to first see Citizen Kane, and The Red Shoes, and The Adding Machine, Witness for the Prosecution, Dr. Faustus, John Wayne in The Conqueror. So I really did have a pretty good cinematic education when I was a kid.
Yes, but the movie...
I mean, our seventh grade geography class watched El Cid, for crying out loud. It took us a whole week, and I still don't remember what point the teacher was trying to make, but we watched El Cid on a 16mm projector, so you can see how much a part of our lives the movies
but
were.
But what about the movie you
see? Oh, yeah, I was getting to that. See, there was one aspect of watching movies in the 70s that really, really sucked. See, during the course of the decade, some revolutionary things started to happen in the horror genre, my favorite then and now. There was a trend away from traditional monsters and gothic castles, and toward something more modern and more cinematic, toward stronger negative emotions and graphic horror and bloodshed, and establishing some sort of connection to life as we knew it. The big bombshell was The Exorcist in 1973. I was about 6 years old when that movie came out, but I still remember the impact it had. People were running out of the theaters in terror. They were screaming, they were vomiting. And then, of course, the next year came Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then came Jaws, and then came The Omen, and after that we had the unforgettable year between late 1978 and 1979, with Halloween and the Amityville Horror, Phantasm, and most of all, Alien. All of those movies have something in common. They're all rated R, which meant that poor me, who was 12 years old at the time that Alien came out, I wasn't allowed to see any of them. And of all the movies I was forced to miss because of my age, it was Alien that hurt the most. For a year I had lived and breathed that movie. I sucked up every bit of publicity I could find about it, and I pined for the day I'd finally get to see it. The one thing that drove me crazy was that the studio had been very secretive about the monster design. No pictures or even descriptions of the monster had been leaked to the public. None. That's the way to drive an adolescent monster movie fan out of his tiny mind. I just had to see what the monster looked like. It just wasn't fair. Now, at that time, I was going to military school, which is a long story I'll tell you later. And since they thought they were preparing us to be tough young men, somebody got the idea to take the entire 8th grade class on a weekend field trip to see the one movie we were all dying to see, Alien. One of the teachers would stand in as our guardian and get us in, and the only thing we needed was permission from our parents. Now, my parents knew how much I'd been waiting to see Alien, even though there was no way in hell either of them would go with me to see it, so when I asked them and told them the school was taking responsibility, they were inclined to let me go. Just out of curiosity, they asked me what it was rated, and I, idiot that I am, told them the truth. That's why I, the biggest monster movie fan in the whole 8th grade, was one of the only kids who did not get to see Alien that weekend. Now, considering how important Alien was to me when I was too young to see it, you might think it would be impossible for me not to have caught up with it when I was old enough, in the age of readily available video. You'd think so.
Ah, so now...
And you'd be absolutely right. One of the very first things I did when I got my hands on my own VCR was to go out and rent Alien. And I loved it, and I still love it, and I watch it regularly.
Mm.
But the point I wanted to make with all
what
of this is...
What is the goddamned movie?
Since I couldn't see these movies that I so desperately wanted to see, these movies I knew were immediately establishing themselves as classics of their genre, I did the next best thing. I read them. See, every big movie at that time, even the modestly budgeted ones, had some kind of book associated with it. Some movies, like Jaws or The Exorcist or Carrie or The Fury or The Manitou or even Audrey Rose, were based on novels to begin with, but others had the novels written later, so when I couldn't see a movie, I got my hands on the paperback. That's how I first experienced Halloween, Halloween 2, Halloween 3, The Fog, The Legacy, The Omen, The Hearse... Oh boy, if you thought the movie was bad, try reading the novel sometime. Dawn of the Dead, I remember that. And of course I read and reread the Alien novelization over and over again until I could almost see the movie in my mind. But what you have to understand about this is that although nobody under 18 could get into an R-rated movie without a parent or guardian, nobody really cared who bought the books. There were no age restrictions, or at least no enforced age restrictions, on buying the novelizations of movies you were too young to watch. Actually, funny story, I don't know if I should be telling you this, but I bought my first piece of pure porn, one of the Christina series by the pseudonymous Blakely St. James, which was a house name of the Playboy Press, when I was 12 years old, straight off the shelf of a local supermarket. Yes. Supermarkets sold porn then, and supermarkets sometimes sold porn to little kids, which is, I guess, why they don't sell porn anymore.
Yeah, those books weren't very good, but now what about the movie?
The what?
The movie!
Oh, yeah, see, the irony is that the novels were full of much more graphic gore, and especially graphic sex, than the movies were. That's why I grew up with a really twisted idea of what R-rated movies were like. You can't imagine how disappointed I was to find out how tame the films were when I finally got a chance to see them. Now, if I'd just been allowed to see the movies in the first place, when I was 12 or 13 and ideally suited to appreciating them, I probably wouldn't have grown up into the pervert I am today.
What was the goddamned movie?
Haven't you guessed? I've mentioned it already. You see, I'd already read the book over and over again for years. I'd seen the production stills. I'd seen clips on TV, I'd heard the movie talked about, I'd seen movies that ripped it off, I'd even read the Mad Magazine parody. And after all that media saturation, I really started to feel, well, not exactly like I'd already seen it, but, well, it had just become so much a part of the cultural landscape that until I had to rack my brains and think of an appropriate movie for this round table, I didn't even realize, consciously, that I hadn't seen it. It's a movie that regularly pops up on top 10, even top 5 horror movie lists for all time. The movie is Carrie, directed by Brian De Palma.
You've never seen Carrie?
Oh, come on, Doc.
A horror movie will be horror, and you've never...
Oh, come on, Doc. This is why I didn't want to do the review in the first place.
Oh, I know what your problem is.
You do?
Yes, your problem is not your feelings of inadequacy.
Then what is it?
Real inadequacy.
I never thought of that. Why, Doc, you're a genius. I feel so much better. I'm cured. I can pontificate again.
Go for it, you crazy, brain-eating son of a bitch.
I will. One of the things I enjoy most about Carrie is that it makes me think back to the original novel without regretting anything, which is not something you can say about practically any other Stephen King adaptation. The film version manages to immerse you in the atmosphere of the novel from the very beginning. If you haven't read the book, the movie gives you all the information you need to understand, and it does so visually, without the need for a lot of talky exposition. Now, the screenplay is by Lawrence Cohen. That's the other Larry Cohen, not the killer baby guy. And naturally, he has to elide a lot of the action to fit into the space of a normal movie, even though Carrie is nowhere near as long as the doorstops that Stephen King is putting out these days. It's still quite a feat, and he's done it very well, to the point where people like me who have read the book, even if we haven't read it in many years, will find ourselves filling in all the details effortlessly. Even more importantly, the film knows where to diverge from the book, where to use visual cues to fill in details that would fall flat if they were simply translated to the screen without any further thought. Even as early as the opening shower scene, which is so crucial to the whole story, it's shot so that we see and feel viscerally the distance between Carrie White and the other high school girls, really between Carrie and the entire rest of the world. We actually see and feel her withdrawing into herself, into her own world, which we will find out is the only safe place she's ever had, only to be betrayed a few moments later by her own body, at least that's the way she experiences it. And Sissy Spacek is magnificent as the girl we should sympathize with, but initially we can't. Not fully, not at first. Because as Carrie overhears her teacher, Miss Collins, say, even though it isn't her fault, there's also something repellent about this twisted wreck of a girl. Miss Collins will later die for that remark, but it's no less true for that. We come to understand Carrie and actually like her as the movie progresses, and our sympathy reaches its height just as her fragile sanity is completely destroyed and she becomes a vengeful monster. But I think one of the biggest issues that comes to me watching Carrie at this late date is the terrifying ambiguity of the prom massacre. You'd have to have a heart of stone not to find some sort of primal satisfaction in Carrie's rampage, even though by that time she's no longer able to distinguish between reality and the images in her head, and even though she's moved way past any possible moral justification for what she's done and what she's doing. There's actually a scene in a later Brian De Palma film that troubles me in a similar way. In The Untouchables, there's a moment when Elliot Ness confronts a gangster he thinks is going to be released on a technicality, and he throws the man off a building to his death. Now, that scene is shot and scored in a way that I've seen bring audiences to their feet cheering. That's absolutely the wrong reaction for that scene. That moment is the moral low point for Elliot Ness, and I've never quite figured out if that moment was intended ironically or not, whether we should feel bad for feeling so good. But I think most of us will recognize that in Carrie, the prom massacre is really just an exaggeration of some of the feelings we all had in our high school days. I'd guess that most people watching Carrie and thinking back to their own childhoods would come to the conclusion that if they'd had Carrie's abilities at least a certain point in their lives, there wouldn't be a high school left unburnt across the whole country. But more seriously, there are plenty of young people who have horrible, hateful things poured into their minds from an early age. There are plenty of young people who feel genuinely alienated and disenfranchised, more than just normal teen angst. And there are plenty of their elders who, however well-intentioned they may be, don't know how to deal with that. It doesn't take a bucket of pig's blood to set some of these young people off, and they don't need Carrie's psychic powers when they can get their hands on, say, a firearm. I mean, even my own local high school here was closed down earlier this year over a gun threat. Some people suggest that horror movies in general are responsible for the climate that produces kids that shoot up schools, as well as any number of other social evils, but I don't buy it. If horror movies really had that much of an impact on the society at large, then this movie, one of the most famous horror movies ever made, and one that regularly pops up on people's top 10 lists of the best and most influential horror films, should have taught us something about our own responsibility for creating our own monsters. Yet, after Columbine, when a memorial was set up for the students who were killed, someone originally included markers for the two students who had done the killing. This was to recognize that their actions and their deaths were part of the tragedy, that these were, after all, children, and that they had ever got to the point of doing such terrible things without anyone intervening or knowing what to do, showed that there was a much bigger problem that needed to be faced. But the memorials to the killers were considered so offensive to the survivors that they were hastily removed. And that leads me to think that maybe the most troubling part of Cary isn't the prom massacre after all. It just might be the spray-painted graffiti at the end of the film. Cary White burns in hell. That's an assessment Cary would have agreed with wholeheartedly by the end of the film. And an assessment a lot of people, some with the best of intentions, worked very hard to see come about.
That was terrible.
Yes, Doc. Yes, it was. And now here comes the theme music back again, so I guess it's time for me to go. So until next time, provided there is a next time after this particularly shameful installment, this is Will T. Brain Eater saying...
So how long have you been hearing theme music?
bye-bye.